The words are coming from Google News.
Union, boss, John.
Oh,
come up here. Come up here, you'll see it.
This is by far our most popular thing, so this is 2-1 more popular than any other exhibit. The artist is really concerned about, you know, our overexposure to information. So he tries to, you know, do a Marshall McLuhan on it. The physics of it is just tremendous. And it, like, what a piece of technology. It's been running for 2 years and it hasn't needed any maintenance.
The voice of David Walsh showing me the curious bit.fall installation by Julius Popp. It's a waterfall of words from Google. Forever different, forever new. Welcome to Late Night Live. Last week we made a trip to Hobart, and these days when you're in Tassie, it's imperative that you visit Mona. Sounds like a complaint, but in fact it's the Museum of Old and New Art, the brainchild of, yes, David Walsh. In collaboration with architect Nonda Katsalidis, David helped design this extraordinary structure, carved deep into the sandstone rock, to house his eclectic collection of brick and brack. Now, like all of us who collect things, David started small, in his case, with a collection of 2,800 pennies inherited from his dad, who'd kept them safe in a bicky tin. And from that moment on, there was no stopping him. David took me on a private tour of Mona after hours, and we began by talking about his Australian art collection and his favourite, Sir Sidney Norman.
Well, I've got a large number of modernist works, you know, all the big names and a few of the lesser names, and I've been particularly obsessed by Nolan. In fact, we're standing near his snake, a 1600 panel thing that is about to come down, actually, for our next exhibition. But yeah, and now we're saying, I noticed in our propaganda, that we were never going to take it down. Now we're saying that we always intended to take it down. And I pretty clearly remember saying that once we got it up, we would never take it down.
So I remember that too. So
we're still telling the truth. It just happens to be completely opposite to what it was before.
Why Nolan?
Relentless self-persecution. He attacks a subject matter until it, you know, has no more blood to bleed. He just cuts it up and he revisits themes from the 40s to the 90s in some cases. So a series for Nolan, or a series for anyone else is, you know, I'll work on this for a few months and then I'll move on to something else. He just keeps coming back to an ideal, to a mechanism that he responds to, and it's really interesting because over, you know, like classics like Ned Kelly over a really long period show a completely different engagement with, you know, for a while he's embedded in the myth and then he's exterior to the myth and then he sees it as, you know, as a defining cultural gesture, you know, like, and then he sees it, the key Irishness of it, and like he just, well, I don't know if he's playing games, but he's certainly analysing and reanalysing.
But I remember the first time I saw Nolan's and the wallop on the walls, you know, the power of the bloody thing.
Yes, he's often described as being technically not resolved, but I find his brushwork totally amazing, you know. And I think it's in Snake, it's clearly demonstrated there's a, because it's such a, well, a huge conception. He's clearly, to me, started at one end and developed a... I'm gesturing, which was totally, so I realise, pointless. He's...
Not on our radio programme. The listener's into gesturing.
Oh, good. He started at one end and he's developing a language, a sort of a repetitive movement, a gestural language, and he's just doing the same things over and over again. And then he's mutating it into these really delicate and exquisite paintings that you see at the far left here that are all bats, and the bats are just done with a couple of swift gestures. They apparently took less than 10 minutes each and they're just totally glorious. So,
and very, very subtle, as opposed to the wallop of the aforementioned paintings like the Kellys.
Yeah, there's a certain darkness in them. One of the reasons for that is because they're crayons and it's covered in glass, so, you know... And he deliberately, he originally chose Perspex because he wanted to flatten the dimensionality, We replaced it with glass, but we tried to get the sort of glass.
Is this
with...
the first time they've all been up together, David, anyway?
It's the first time to the public, but there was an... No, that's not true either. Twice before, once in Dublin, the exhibition, which had Snake and its two companion pieces, Paradise Garden, and Shark, that we also own, and another time for a BBC documentary in a hangar in London.
Yeah.
Never in Australia before. And probably never in Australia again.
Old and new. Which has the greatest pull on you now?
Now, I don't know. It probably changes from day to day, but most of the things that I buy, possibly due to access and having my fingers burnt a few times by, as you called them before, when we were chatting, dodgy dealer. Well, you know, I've been a little put off collecting antiquities, and also I've started to understand that, you know, without really careful attention to detail, antiquities collection can have some serious taint attached to it because, you know, these works can have been pillaged. So you've got to make sure there's a serious provenance in the stuff you're buying. Right now, I'm not buying much. I've got a few big commissions on the go. Commissions obviously don't have any antiquity attached.
They will one day.
Well, that's the funny thing. I tend to think that this gallery, most of the contemporary works in this gallery, probably won't be of any interest to anyone in 10 or 50 years. You know, if you think about everything that was painted in the 40s when Boyd was doing this, most of it has become uninteresting. It's in attics somewhere, or it's been disposed of, you know. They don't hang around. The few that hang around are the ones that we decide matter, or the ones that just, you know, provenance decides matter. It can just be a fluke as much as anything. Anyway, I still prefer to keep the old and the new in my hair room, I think.
We're taking a walk around Mona, Hobart's Museum of Old and New Art, with its creator, David Walsh. You talked about the mortality of artworks, and you've also talked about the mortality of this extraordinary venture, because speculation is it couldn't long outlive you. No government could afford the bills that you're writing out to keep it going. Do you care about that?
I didn't before I opened. In fact, the BRW quoted me as saying that if nobody came, I'd just turn the air conditioning off and sit on a couch and watch the art rot. But I've somewhat changed my mind. I've seen some hugely positive... I've just got people on the street come up to me and say thank you, and they say it in the most endearing ways because they sort of treat it as our Mona. I constantly get this thing that causes me dissonance. It goes... our museum, and because of my heritage and because I went to TMAG, I always think they mean TMAG. It still captures me and I...
Catches and touches.
Yes, the moments can be very touching indeed. I had a bloke come up with a few-month-old child, and he says, I didn't want to do this, but my baby insisted. He wanted me to come and tell you what a wonderful thing you've done. So, you know, just it's sweet and cute.
You couldn't have calculated the scale of the success, could you? I know you didn't.
The number of visitors we get is approximately what I predicted, but I didn't anticipate that they would be as committed, you know, as involved, and you know, people send me presents. Appropriately perhaps, but surprisingly, people send me bottles of wine. Like, this is an amazing thing. I didn't anticipate that. But anyway,
they probably named their children after you, David.
Well, there are a lot of children called.
Have you checked the list?
A lot of children called David. I can't assume that they're named after me unless perhaps they're girls.
Unless there's been a bump in the rate of christening,
or that it starts being a girl's name. In 50 years, you know, I'll be dead. The waters will be rising outside. We're close to water level, and I used to think that didn't matter, but because of the community response and because I see things like, you know, great restaurants and a bit of a buzz in Hobart, I'm starting to think, well, I'm actually not just starting to think, I've been thinking for a year now that I probably need to figure out a way of perpetuating Mona and, you know, figuring out how to get enough money together to have you know, if something happened after I'm dead, and of course it won't be what I would have wanted to happen, but I don't care much about that.
Well, there are, around the world, just simply hundreds of museums of various sizes and shapes, which were created by eccentrics, frequently wealthy eccentrics, which have survived their death. Some of my favourites, like the Frick, say, in New York, which is the opposite of this, you know, it's subtle and quiet, you know.
But it's a
bloody good collection.
Yes, well, they're one of the places that has had conversations with us about the O, you know, the drawing device, so... Yeah, I mean, their aesthetic would do well to get labels off the walls. So, some of my favourites tend to be the obscure but personal, sort of indulgent.
Soames in London, do you like Soames?
No, I love Soames. Yeah. Louisiana in Copenhagen, but my favourite would have to be the Dolores Olmedo in Mexico City, which, you know, she was a collector and friend of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, and I think the galleries brings the artists and the collector alive. It's phenomenal, and you know, but I don't think any of those are models for this. I just think Whimsy is a model for this, as it was for those. The only common heritage is just doing something for want of something to do, you know, not having a particularly deep plan except to learn, you know, not to teach, to learn.
That's why I have this radio program. It's not to teach, it's to learn. Yeah. It's, you know, to extend my abbreviated education. Let's go back to this Catholic atheist proposition of yours, which I find intriguing. How much Catholic, how much atheist?
Yeah, well, I mean, I noticed, well, I don't know if I read, this will probably turn out to be a myth too, that you stopped being a believer when you were about 5. It wasn't the case for me. I was a bit older and I don't really know, I can't pin it down precisely, but I think I was probably 10 or 12. And prior to that, I was, you know, extremely committed. Like I don't know, I went through the rituals, even though they seemed pretty empty to me. But I was simultaneously committed to the notion that you can extract reality from the world, that, you know,
I'm sorry, extract reality?
Well, you know, that with appropriate effort and appropriate methodology, you can...
Hang on a sec, David. Something has just happened, but hang on.
Ask me the question again.
David, we were just sort of run over by a huge sound effect. You were talking about how you started to lose momentum within Catholicism because you found it all a bit implausible.
Well, not because I found it implausible. I mean, I always found it implausible, even when I was committed to it. Like, I was committed to it as, you know, as an act of desperation, or perhaps... It's difficult for me to understand why. But I simultaneously, you know, had this notion and, you know, read science books, the notion being that reality could be discovered, that, you know, there seem to be two skeins of myth structures that inhabit the planet now, and one is this divine revelation that there is absolute knowledge and good and evil, and the other one is that there's no reality and it's just, you know, that we're just engaged in a narrative, what you know, postmodernism, as it's called in the arts, or scientists call it instrumentalism, and I just think that neither of those are descriptions of what reality is. You can extract rules that systematise the universe, and, you know, it isn't complete order, but it's now starting to be known that we can't know everything, but certainly we can extract
a hell of a lot.
We can extract reality, and reality is pretty bloody interesting, and the mechanisms by which we extract it are themselves very, very interesting. So I became aware of scientific method, or, you know, I guess it's scepticism or doubt is another phrase for it, and it was really enlightening to me.
Haven't you, to some extent, applied scientific scepticism and analysis to your profession? And I'm talking about your ability to make lots of money out of gambling systems. Isn't that another way?
It's a pretty... My father trained in bet on greyhounds, although his bets were infinitesimal. It got me interested. A few of my mates were in the casinos, and I got interested through vectors other than science, but eventually you know, I turned my limited mathematical skills onto it, and they theirs, and, you know, we gradually learnt more and more about the sort of techniques that were appropriate. And after doing something for 35 years, you do know a great deal about it. And, yeah, it's quite a mathematical exercise now, but it wasn't always.
Going back to Catholicism, death, it's always seemed to me that art is driven by an apprehension of death, often a terror of it, and whether that involves pyramid building or Woody Allen making films. It's art is very often an act of defiance against death or denial of death or an attempt to transcend it by creating something which will survive beyond the death of the artist.
Yeah, it's all of that, and sometimes it's an artist pretending that he's not scared of death, like it's an active pseudo-engagement. But it's a dangerous subject for me, because every time I talk about the motives for creating art, I talk about the obvious ones, the ones that you just mentioned, like sex and death, and the upshot is that I'm keep getting described as a, you know, museum of sex and death. And
I don't think I've even mentioned sex yet. But
no, but we're going to get to it. Well, we have gotten to it. We're there. So this is, you know, yeah. Yeah, theory and you know, basically it's about, you know, about creating power structures and about avoiding, you know, obvious mortality.
But it's also about fun. Art is also about fun. I don't know if you've been into Altamira or and looked at the great cave paintings. But you cannot persuade me that the artists who did these extraordinary works tens of thousands of years ago weren't enjoying the physicality of painting, just as potters like having great gobs of clay in their hands.
Yes, you can't stop kids doing stuff with their hands, you know, immersing themselves in paint or, you know, it's a very real thing, and, you know, I guess it's part of us not really being a blank slate, you know. This seeking pleasure, which some have described as making special, that's, you know, a biological propensity that we have. Art is inherently fun.
And you're having fun here too. A lot of this is fun for
you. Certainly, I sometimes wander down at night because I live in an apartment attached to the gallery, and
you live above the shop.
I actually live above the Nolan Gallery, so yeah, I can see through the floor to the Nolan Gallery, and I find myself wandering down here with a glass of wine or a beer, and it makes me giggle, you know, like I wonder if security are watching when I'm having fits of acknowledging my own good fortune. So it's a splendid thing. I always thought that it'd be about the doing of it, but having done it is pretty satisfying too.
I mean, you are, and I am, terribly interested in what creates art, what the driving force is. And you are having an exhibition, I understand, to examine just that proposition.
Yes, the exhibition will replace Theatre of the World, which is on now in 6 or 8 weeks, and it's called The Red Queen, the reference to, you know, I think it's through the looking glass and running as fast as you can, and but only staying in the same place is a standard part of evolutionary theory. So, I guess we're looking at the sort of things that we were just discussing, the motives for creating art. And we have a bunch of proximate motives, a bunch of things that make us do the things, and they're cultural and they're credible, and when they're described they sound very, very sensible, but there are much deeper motives than that, in my opinion, and those motives are, you know, the creation of art has evolutionary value. One obvious one is it makes men attractive. It's a way of showing excess capacity, like a red car, but not a red car that's as fat as the one we just saw.
In other words, a part of a mating ritual, which is driven by evolution.
Yeah, it's sexual selection, Darwin knew about it, and, you know, I guess it's pretty widely accepted now that it's one of the mechanisms that causes to make art. Another one that we're proposing to explore, perhaps not in the next exhibition or not directly in the next exhibition, but soon, is the narrative basis of art. If a parent tells a child a story, he or she is inculcating in that child a capacity to plan, to consider possible futures. A fictive future, you know, something you make up, can be real. You know, it's about what's optionality. It's about exploring possibilities. That clearly has a survival basis to it. And so, you know, if the basis of creativity has a increases survivability and there's a genetic component to it, then it'll be selected for. Telling stories, creating theatre, basically using narrative, is an evolutionary compulsion.
I'm just reading the latest book, by Oliver Sacks. It's called Hallucinations, and he studies the role of the hallucination right throughout history and through a plethora of medical conditions. And in the process of doing so, admits that when he was a young medical trainee in California in, the 60s, he ingested vast amounts of drugs so he could, in fact, hallucinate, so he could enter these sorts of worlds. And that's something else that I think art has in common, that it is also a form of hallucination.
And the creators of it are on the continuum of, you know, engagement with the senses from, you know, from normalcy to, say, large dose of LSD tend naturally to be off away from the centre. Oliver Sacks is a really interesting character because, for example, he has all sorts of, you know, neurological disabilities.
He can't recognise faces.
He can't navigate in the city. So, yes, he has what's it called? Prosopagnosia, the inability to recognise people. And he, he looks to me to be the classic sort of creative guy. He learned to play piano because it's the sort of thing he can do in, you know. It's easy to write his history in terms of his disability, you know.
Well, you know, but nothing like good enough. Nothing like good enough, because he's much more than a pile of symptoms.
Right, that's my point. But what I'm saying is there are propensities there that give him, that they don't make him what he is. He has to do a tremendous amount of work for it. But he wasn't a blank slate to begin with. He had certain inadequacies and certain propensities that, you know, nudged him in a direction. And, yeah, he went very far in that direction and became a very creative and wonderful man. Actually, Hallucinations is sitting on my kitchen table at the moment, but I haven't opened it yet. I tend not to read books at the moment. I tend to read them on iPad so I can make notes. But someone gave me the book, so I'll probably read this one in ink and paper.
Okay, did you ever try that route to change your own perceptions before you started buying art to help you do so?
Not to change my own perceptions, mainly as a result of, you know, some peer group pressure and some natural interest in experimentation and also some pleasure. The hallucinogenics didn't particularly interest me much, but I have, you know, certainly in years gone by enjoyed ecstasy when it first came on the market. The sort of my emotional engagement, particularly as a kid, wasn't particularly profound. I certainly got some insights that I didn't otherwise have, and I think they may even have stayed with me as a result of ecstasy. There's no doubt that even if it's, you know, to a very small degree, I've been changed by drugs. But I guess, you know, if you look at tribal engagements, drugs are sort of as much, you know.
They're fundamental to so many religious experiences.
Yeah, I hesitate to use the word natural, but, you know, there are so many ways that our reality can be altered. That, you know, dietary changes, like if you think about Paleolithic man, he's a hunter, not, you know, like say in Siberia in a cold climate. They're eating infrequently. They're eating once or twice a week, and, you know, and they're feasting and fasting, and like that alters the way you experience the world. You know, we are designed to respond to stresses. We are what's called anti-fragile in at least one book. We're not robust again. We don't just not deteriorate. When we do exercise or when we change our dietary patterns or when we change the things we do, you know, Mithridatism, this taking a small amount of poison to protect yourself from it, as Mithridates and Pontus did, we actually improve. We are designed to be stressed, you know. And one of the ways to stress us is to have to ingest substances we don't regularly ingest. And, you know, new perceived realities are in the narrative form until, you know, until they're tested by experimentation and hypothesis, are just as real as any other mechanism for personalising the world.
Were you a bit shocked when people weren't as shocked by your museum as you might have expected?
I was stupefied. It was... My marketing plan essentially was to get, you know...
Closed down.
To get picketed and, you know, a few protests, placard. I mean, the Mercury wrote an editorial a few days after we, you know, and it was an well-written, thoughtful editorial, which ended with something like, you know, you've entertained us, you've provoked us, but if you think you're going to shock us with what you've done so far, you're going to have to try hard. I'm reading this in the Mercury. Like, I'm thinking, you know... It was my marketing plan, so, like, my plan B was to get lucky.
But that, that goes back to your idea of us being much more robust than we think we are as a species.
I want to... The word robust is not what I'm talking about. Robust is building a really strong building like the pyramids that falls down gradually. We're the opposite of fragile. We're anti-fragile.
Gotcha.
If you try to knock us down, we get stronger.
Yeah.
And yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I've always found people far less shockable than you're led to believe. On almost every social issue, they're usually light years ahead of their politicians.
Yes,
but coming back to the word sex, when I think of art, I often see a great celebration of simple, good old-fashioned sexuality and fun. You'd be well aware that very often Picasso would make the basic vase shape, you know, going down to a narrow waist and then widening out like buttocks, and he'd paint a woman's bum on that curve. He'd exploit the sexuality of the shape. And the same thing applies, say, to a guitar. There's a huge amount of art objects, musical instruments and all sorts of things, which are reflective of the joy in sexuality. Yet the world is full of people who don't want that joy, who want to forbid it, who want to crush it under taboos.
That's probably true, but I never... It wasn't a motivator for me to actually, you know, to highlight or enhance sexuality. I'm not above gratuitous sexual images at all, but I certainly think it's interesting that we suppress urges, and I think that one of the reasons we suppress it, we have the urges suppressed for us, is because it inhabits power structures, you know. Picasso certainly didn't lack for available partners. I suspect that it made him a lot more attractive that he could engage sexuality so at times elegantly and at times brutally. I mean, Whiteley reversed all that and took really beautiful women and somehow kept them sexual but distorted them. And I think that was, you know, a pretty profound engagement in what it actually is, because it's the image in our mind that we create rather than the depiction on paper. You know, it's... I don't need to be a sexual crusader because I just never had this feeling that I had anything to fear from sexuality. So, and that may have come from the fact that I was late to sex because I was so introverted as a kid. I never really had that point where I didn't know what I wanted. But in art, it's omnipresent. It's like I'm just looking around at the work we can see. There's one complex abstract from a Belgian guy called Peter Buggenhout above us that you can't interpret as anything. But I'd say there's a strong and deliberate effort on his part to avoid those shapes that can be interpreted, because as soon as he gave them, the first thing we would see is human forms, or, you know, aids to sexuality.
We react when we look at rocks in nature. We see faces, we see elephants, we see whales.
Yeah,
we find it comforting to find things other than the rocks to look at.
It's curious. I mean, are we imposing our own reality on those shapes, or are they, in a sense, actually there? Like, the mechanisms that create smooth curves, you know, erosion, exfoliation, all that sort of stuff, you know, are producing shapes that are robust, and this time I mean robust, against intervention, and that's the sort of shape that we're logically designed for. You know, we're designed by an arbitrary system, but the arbitrary system produces pretty good outcomes. So
it's very messy, though, of course, doesn't it? For every surviving life form, there are thousands of failures. But that's also a bit like art, isn't it?
That is anti-fragile. The way evolution works is by being, by ridding itself of its, not of its failures, because, you know, some of the failures are a lot more successful than us. You know, the biomass of certain species of bacteria that are now extinct far exceeds anything that the human race has achieved or probably ever will achieve. But, yeah, so I hesitate to use the word failure, but it's the simplest word to use. In the Red Queen's race, in the constant competition, some fall behind in the race. They're eliminated, and what's perpetuated is the thing that's most robust in the environment that it occupies. Individual species can be robust and last a long time. The whole ecosphere is anti-fragile, and it will, while ever the ecosystem is survivable, it will find a way.
I think that's very much a huge political issue at the moment, isn't it, with the prognostications on climate change. And here you've got the inventor of the Gaia hypothesis, James Lovelock, saying we've overloaded the system and we've destroyed its ability to recover.
He's talking very specifically in relation to human beings. You know, the Earth will cope with our accidentally malicious intervention, but you know, it'll produce a new biosphere. It just might not be suitable for us.
Just as the jungles covered, you know, the Aztec and the Toltec and the Mayan temples. In other words, a civilization, a species disappears and the planet keeps throbbing away.
Well, 600 million years ago, the whole Earth was a, and also a couple of billion years before that, the entire oceans and all the land masses were covered in glaciers, snowball Earth, you know. Life survived under the, you know, in the ocean. And, you know, here we are.
Let's go back to the Catholic atheist paradox. I don't know that it is a paradox, actually, but most people would see it as one. You talk a lot about power. You keep referring to power structures. Did you find, or still do you find, some attractions in, say, the Catholic power structure that are important to you?
No. I can say that with rare certainty. I find that, you know, I look to manage anything I'm involved in that I have a say in the management of by trying to flatten structures. You know, I hold a position that the human race is just another species, and I sort of, you know, when I was talking about, you know, success, failure, I don't like to use those terms. You know, we happen to be able to cognitively explore places that evolutionary strategies can't, so information can be created by the human mind that can't otherwise be created. I don't know if that's interesting, and I don't know if the nature of power is interesting, except as a tool for understanding. You know, there is certainly a biological compulsion to try to garner some power, and I think most people feel it, and I think I've started to feel it, but prior to building Mona, that certainly was, I didn't expect anyone to care what I thought, you know. And as I say, a lot of it was about entertaining and educating me.
But you do care. You wrote a really interesting essay for Griffith Review.
I said I didn't expect to care. I was very specifically talking about a time prior to Mona opening. Yeah, but that essay in itself is a denial of my personal certainty. I think that power structures often emerge from revelation and certainty. And I think a really sensible, engaging way of seeing the world is to just be doubtful.
David Walsh on LNL. on RN. And we're at Mona.
Yeah, it's nothing.
I once believed that someone else said this, but I've got a feeling now that it's a sort of a confabulation on my part. But, you know, being an atheist is no more a belief than not playing chess as a hobby. So it's the act of not doing something. Where does the burden of proof lie? It always lies with the contention, not with those that don't believe it.
And yet, in the sort of crazy world, that's flipped upside down. And the atheist is seen as the asserter.
Now, that's absolutely right. I mean, it may well be that the biological state, the natural biological state for human beings is to believe. There may be evolutionary pressure. Like, you know, atheists have been described as a herd of cats. You can't get them to go in the same direction. And that's a good thing. That's a virtue. But it's not a virtue if you're talking about conquest, you know, armies of conquest. You know, you're trying to kill a whole bunch of people. You're better off all believing the same thing than all not believing the same thing. There, maybe it's not much of a virtue, their belief has a virtue.
This place is a monument to curiosity, and that's the other great inbuilt human aspect that drives us, that makes us interesting, that makes us dangerous.
Yeah, that'd make a good headstone, you know. The monument to curiosity, that's known. That'd just be, you know, to leave everything else out and then make people wonder, you know, who or what is buried there. Well, this is a mausoleum to curiosity, yeah.
Well, you force people to be curious. You mentioned it in passing, but let us say it again. There are no explanatory things stuck around the walls here, are there?
The thing about Mona, compared to, say, a state museum, is a state museum is an engagement in certainty. You know, it protects the belief of the state, what good taste is, you know, enter our portals and be enlightened, right? So that's essentially autocracy, and we're essentially anarchic. We give you the capacity to form your own opinions, and we are so uncertain, we engage so obviously in doubt, that you feel empowered, because if we don't know what we're talking about, why should you be worried about being wrong or ill-informed or overstated or even, you know, even fearful of being right occasionally? I think I give people the opportunity to have an opinion.
If you go into a major museum, art gallery anywhere on earth, a major one, you are going into a cathedral, you're going into something which really is a mock religious or genuinely religious experience. That's not what you wanted to do here. What atmosphere do you think you've created?
Well, we were trying to, I mean, consciously, and most of the things that I did weren't conscious, but we were trying to extract that exact, you know, that pathos, that engagement, the sort of thing that the St. Peter's and St. Paul's and St. Mary's of this world give you, but in an entirely secular way. So I described it, and I'm still happy to use the term, as a secular temple. So, yeah, I'm...
That sounds like A.C. Grayling.
Yeah.
Who writes along those lines.
I read that book, the Atheist Bible, or whatever it's called, and I didn't finish it because I found it, you know, like, he took the metaphor way too far. But maybe I've taken the metaphor way too far as well, but, you know, like, it's difficult to judge from within. But anyway, I've certainly played with that metaphor. We're thinking about the same things, and maybe we've just done them in slightly different ways.
I was talking to Anthony the other night, and he now pushes the humanist barrier. He wants people to be not simply atheists, but humanists. Atheism being negative, simply saying no. Humanism being positive, a celebration of life in its own terms. But my problem with that argument is incrementally it becomes another ism. Well, it is humanism. A humanist is another ist. And if you're not very careful, you finish up with another form of theology.
Aren't you afraid of the term atheism then? But it doesn't concern me. I'm not really interested in labels, like, you know, when
walls or
anywhere. When these, you know, conceited types you know, atheist conceited types decide to call themselves brights, it makes me chuckle, the analogy to a term. It's like Melbourne trying to build an opera house and continually failing. You can't create something with the iconic status of a term like gay deliberately. It has to be an emergent process. As soon as you're that self-aware, it just becomes self-indulgence. So I don't much care about the terminology. Humanism. Isaac Asimov, the American biochemist and science fiction writer, described himself as a humanist for those sorts of reasons. Humanism, I guess the term is loaded a little with moral content, this idea that you can engage the world without belief and still see it as moral. In fact, I would say that, if you're afraid of being punished for a misdeed, that's not a moral act. That's a compelled act, but it's a natural term because theists and deists have typically suggested that atheism can't be inherently moral, so you might as well load the terminology, but loading the terminology deliberately rather than it emerging is to me a dangerous game. I don't care what I call myself, I just believe in the sort of things that these days have lost currency, like reductionism, rationalism. I believe that the world is inherently elegant and,
you're not tempted to take the next step like my old mate Paul Davies does and insist that that elegance must have an author.
It has an author, and the author is the abundant rules, that the universe confines itself to. If it could go anywhere, it wouldn't be interesting. It is constrained, and the constraints are inherently appealing because any system that we inhabit will be apparently perversely suited to our inhabiting it.
And we admit to the possibility there may be other systems where we wouldn't fit in.
Yes, and if we did, but whatever, if they were capable of being inhabited, and they were inhabited, they would be inhabited in a way that was appropriate for them. Because most universes that could emerge, you change any of a number of constants just a little bit, and this is the thing that gets Paul Davies, they don't work anymore. So his solution is that they have... It seems to me that all that just means one of two things. Either there's a lot of universes, or that there are mechanisms that we are not yet aware of that tune the constants appropriately. What he's doing is essentially God of the gaps. Throughout the last umpteen thousand years, the reason for believing in something beyond rationality has reduced and reduced and reduced to the point where it's, just a glimmer of hope. But that's where people like Mr. Davies reside. I've always had trouble reading. He writes about the exact sort of things that I want to read about, but I always get a bad taste in my mouth. I always think that there's an element of superciliousness in his overlay of belief. I could be wrong. I'm sure he's a very nice bloke.
Death. Does personal death concern you, or does the brevity of life exhilarate?
Impersonal death definitely doesn't concern me. I can't imagine worrying too much about humanity not being here at some point in the future. But, no. Yeah, I worry. I'm going to get to that. I worry about death. I worry about my death. I've been thinking about it quite a lot because I just recently had a 35-year friend die of cancer, and, he suffered, and he was a guy that wasn't afraid, and he became afraid, and, he turned inwards, and then he turned outwards, and I'm perhaps afraid of engaging myths, I suspect I won't, but I would hate to do myself the indignity of suddenly trying to believe that something will save me. My brother, when he died of cancer about 20 years ago. We were, a Christian friend of his visited the very day before he died, and he sort of asked that question, and Tim said, "I'm the atheist I always was," and I, and the effort it took him to say it, because he was, almost incapable of speech, just gave me great satisfaction, and it still does. I'm afraid of death. I'm afraid of... I know it's inevitable, but one of the things that I celebrate is the incredible good fortune. Like, I'm the product of 1.2 billion years of successful sexual matings, you know. Look at the phase space that I'm dealing with and the unlikelihood of having been here in the first place. It's an incredible thing. And to me, I can't deal with the misfortune that my inevitable death will bring me without in concert considering how incredibly fortunate I was to be here in the first place.
That's something I've been writing about for 50 years. The miraculous, the impossible, remote, statistical impossibility, coming back to your world, of us even existing in the first place. We are so bloody lucky.
Yes, we are lucky. But if you go back the 1.2 billion years to the, you know, sexual strategy being invented by some, you know, species of archaea or bacteria, I can't remember which, you get the... And then if you run history backwards, you say, how incredible, but wherever it went, there would have been something. And wherever it went, that something, if it became cognitive, is eventually going to be surprised that it's here. You know, we are infinitesimally unlikely, but the phase space is enormous. And if you multiply a very large number by a very small number, you get a probability that might be close to one. We don't know. It might still be infinitesimal, right? And that's a very real question. Have we inherently been lucky? Or is it certain, or nearly certain, that something would have happened that's cognitive? You know, does quantum mechanics may well require cognition to have the wave collapse, for the probability to become reality? That's, you know, one interpretation of quantum mechanics. It's
Do you understand quantum mechanics?
I understand the mathematics. It's a difficult question. I mean, it's like saying, do I understand, you know, an erection? You know, like, I know what it's for, and I certainly can see applications of it, and I can figure out how it... Well, I can't personally figure out, but I can follow those that figured out how it happened. I have... Fortunately, a mathematical background, and quantum mechanics is inherently mathematical, but I can't necessarily visualise all of the consequences. I can describe them. And, you know, there are every day, or, you know, literally every day, consequences of quantum mechanics are discovered that we didn't know before. So I understand that it's probably the most salient theory of the 20th century.
Being almost totally innumerous, I'm easily persuaded that the most beautiful language in the universe is mathematics. Everyone tells mathematicians always tell me that. And I wonder whether at any point you were tempted to try and create a museum for mathematics as being a science, an art, or whatever it is.
Yes, I have been designing for a few years, and I won't be building it because I need a... But if there's, you know, some... king or some corrupt official somewhere that's, you know, considering applying for readmission to the human race with $500 million that is extorted, I'm very happy to take that money and build him a monument that everyone will remember for at least a few weeks. But and it would be mathematically based. I would use art, and I would, you know, try to show the scales, the nature of phenomena, and I think I can. As I say, I've been thinking about this for a few years, and I could just do, and I probably will one day, just do exhibitions in this gallery that bring art and science and the commonality of all knowledge together. But I'd like to do it on a grand scale if anyone ever gives me the opportunity to.
Well, clearly the links between mathematics and music are well known and fairly well explored. Are we surrounded by mathematics here with your works of art?
Yes. Every artist engages their own biochemistry and their own... Like, everything is inherently based on an elegantly structured mathematical universe. The thing I wonder about is, you know, are particles and matter and all the things that we... You know, the waves that we create when I speak to you and the electrons that are created by the microphone, are all of these things merely information in mathematical language? Or... Like, is reality embedded in the mathematical substrate of the universe rather than it being, like, in other words, is the universe a virtual reality system with somewhat more depth than the ones we can construct? It's something that doesn't explain anything, because at some point, it's an infinite recession, at some point you have to find who or what embedded the system, in the mathematics in the system, or the system in the mathematics.
But tell you what, David, it's bloody exciting stuff, isn't it, eh?
The opportunity to try to understand, you know, when there's revelation, when things are given to you, that satisfaction is a lot like, to use the musical analogy that you mentioned before, it's a lot like being able to play the piano without learning. What good is that? You know, how satisfying is it to just have something? Nothing shits me more than people being described as having a gift, you know. It's attributed to Lee Trevino occasionally, a golfer. The more I practice, the luckier I get, he said, you know. If you're good at something, you've got a small early propensity for it, and you're slightly better than everyone else, and you keep doing it, and you're doing it, and a large component of the mechanism that makes you good at it might be drive rather than capacity, you know. And that drive in itself is a capacity, but it's a small thing, you know. Genius isn't a real thing. This bloody, you know, brilliant, he's been able to hit a target that no one else can hit. Genius is being able to hit a target that no one else can see. That sort of glibness shits me to tears.
There's not a Michelangelo that I've seen so far, but he's a great case in point.
Yeah, well, Michelangelo, you know, lived into his 80s, and in his 80s, he became the first person in the West that started messing around with abstraction. But he started doing sculptural abstractions, and, like, no one would look at him, and they were panned, and then he died, but, like, Michelangelo actually, it's not widely known, but he actually started doing what looked like abstract sculptures. His physical dexterity vanished, so he found something else to do. And, you know, it's a really interesting something else. Necessity, as always, the mother of invention, made him continue to create and innovate, but it took him 60 years to get somewhere that we now consider a fundamental invention of the 20th century, when we ignore the hundreds of tribal and other cultures that also had abstraction in there and our prehistory. So, yeah, the myth of discovery, you know, we gradually learn.
David, thanks. Quite simply, thank you. It's been great to talk to you and to revisit this quite strange place.
It's nice to have you here. I was expecting you to have a camera, because I thought, we're going for a walk in the gallery, this must be for television. So I put on a beautiful orange jacket. I just wished, and everyone could see it. I don't.
The founder, the creator, and yes, the financier of Mona, David Walsh. You can see photos of David's beloved jacket on our website. Just put Mona and Late Night Live into your search engine. And while you're there, you're welcome to leave your comments about the program. That's your lot for this week. Stick around for the news on RN.